President of the Inaugurated Clothing Workers of America, who received his Bachelor of Laws from Northwestern University. In 1949, he was named attorney for the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. He's on the board of directors of the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of Bank of New York, chairman of the board of the Amalgamated Life and Health Insurance Company, a member of the executive council of the AFL-CIO, a former manager of two major affiliate unions in Chicago, and presently living in New York City, which is an economic experience all itself.
Thank you for the introduction, Mr. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Joint Economic Committee, Mr. Brown is introduction stated, I moved to New York in 72, which is one of the reasons we have the great interest in the problem of unemployment. We're discussing today, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, one of the great issues that faces our nation. The problem of jobs for people, the problem of unemployment. And it's of course appropriate that we're doing this on the 30th anniversary of the Act of 1946. The Act, as we all know, stated in its preambles and its objectives the hopes of having high employment and production for all people. I suppose one of the great accomplishments of the Act, of course, was the establishment of the Joint Economic Committee, under whose auspices we're so appropriately being here. I filed a more detailed statement. If you'll permit me, I'll try to very briefly give a summary overview of the outlook that we see, the problems of what has taken place since the Act of 46, the defects and the hopes and so forth. I may open up, if I will, a very simple position that the labor movement can, I don't see how anyone else can really disagree, and to what we're talking about when we talk about full employment. And to us, it's a very simple thing. Full employment means job opportunities and decent wages for all those who are able to work and seek employment. And to say to somebody who's looking for work, you could be home canning and therefore you shouldn't be included, or cleaning the house, seems to us to beg the real issue. So starting with that thing, that all those who are seeking work actively in a decent way, it's simple and an archetype as accurate as to say a description of what full employment is. Let's take a brief look at the record of 30 years since the Act of 46. It is clear that our national economic policy is ever coming too close to full employment. The average unemployment rate is 47, slightly under 5%, 4.9% in the whole period. The record, of course, in the last couple of years indicates how truly dismal the situation has been, can become, when we have no true national policy affecting employment. And as we all know, that the official figure is 7.6. You calculate those who ceased looking for work, those who are working part-time or less than full, but who want to work full-time. And that's not close to the
46, barring the last year or so in terms of definition. But each
each time in the ups and downs of our record of unemployment, and each recession and recovery, the level of unemployment was at a higher figure than the prior level. And see these if you take a quick look. Truman era 47-53, where the average unemployment was 4%. At the end of that period, it was 3.9, 2.9. Then the Eisenhower from 53 to 61, we had an average 5.1% unemployment. Started at 2.9 and then went up to 6.7 at the end. The Kennedy-Johnson had an average of 4.7, going from the 6.7 down to 3.5 at the end of that period. And then, of course, the Nixon-Ford, 2.75, with an average of 5.6, ending, of course, an average of 75 with 8.5% of the money. So we've seen a period of increasing averages of unemployment with the ups and downs. During the same period, there have been rapid changes in technology and vast shifts in the structure of our labor force. And the people themselves have had the force to accept the consequences of the change. The declines in employment in agriculture, mining, railroads, manufacturing, while other industries such as finance, real estate, and state local government have increased their employment. And in this shift, the people who were lost jobs were left to fend for themselves without any meaningful recourse or programs to handle the problem. Same period, the output of man hour productivity has been increasing at an accelerating rate. Shrinkage in our armed forces, and this is not mentioned as a matter of objection, I mentioned this as a matter of statistics, with a million less than a standard and now there's 3 million. Let's put another million or so people out of the labor force. The large migrations that have occurred, the blacks out of the rural areas into our major cities, the whites are leaving our inner cities in the suburbs, the in-migration, the Spanish-speaking from Puerto Rico, Mexico, and other areas, have all caused dislocations and distortions in our unemployment figures. It's a problem we know. In addition to the internal structural changes, there has been a deteriorating job situation which has been exacerbated by the international problems of trade. There are hundreds of thousands of jobs that have been wiped out by the increase of imports from abroad. This has been the cause of loss of these jobs in electronics, steel, glass, and so forth. And the industry I'm most familiar with, the apparel, in the year of 75, when actual production dropped 20-25%, depending on the particular sector. Imports were increasing as much as 40%, 25%, 30%, depending on the particular item. In the year when we were in the highest, one of the worst recessions, we found that our trade policy has caused an increase in imports. At the same time, in the same industry, there was a decrease in terms of actual output domestically. And while we've had a number of training programs, all of which are meritorious that have been developed during this period, unfortunately, these programs have not been linked up with job creation. So we are training people, but But when they're done with the training, there's no correlation between the training and the job that may or may not have been available. We have never developed an adequate system of job delivery. Our U.S. Employment Service has not been effective. The current existing state programs are horrendous. And so the problem of placing people into jobs that are available has been a neglected area in our country. Congress, with the exception they have for the building trade, where a fairly adequate system has been developed between job openings and people available for them. I don't have to really point out the comparisons we can make with the two worlds, Western Europe and Japan, where the unemployment rates that we have in this country would probably cause an internal revolution if any of those countries even approach nearly the unemployment rate we have. If one looks at this overview, it seems clear that if any organization, whether private industry or labor union, unplanned and was as short-sighted and looking over the major ups and downs and changes as we have as a nation on that most basic thing that we're concerned with, the ability to supply our people with jobs, no manager of an organization would remain in office for any length of period. So if we look back in the 30 years, it becomes clear. We have done this by fits, by starts, by short-sighted, we've acted maybe in the sense of firing, without truly looking over the problem that really exists. And so while all this is a kind of an unhappy overview, I will close with one kind of an optimistic picture. And that is the bill that the Senate introduced this past Friday, the Humphrey Hawkins bill, begins to look
by the way, I excluded the Great Depression because obviously there was prior to the So I took the period from 1899 to 1929 and compared it with the period 1946, of course, to today. And let me just say that in brief, if one looks simply at the overall figures, the comparison does not suggest that we had, that something came in 1946 which gave us the capability for a startlingly improved economic performance. If we look at that earlier 30-year period, civilian employment actually increased slightly more rapidly on the average than it has during this more recent period. Real output also increased slightly more rapidly then, and of course real personal consumption expenditures increased significantly more rapidly, and the rate of inflation in the last 30 years, or 29 years, has been somewhat greater than was true in this earlier period. And I suppose it might come as somewhat of a surprise, at least to some, that even the incidence of cyclical performance in these two 30-year periods turns out to be remarkably similar. As a matter of fact, in terms of the number of years in which real output declined, it turned out that for each of these periods, that number was 6. Now, we do have to point out, Finley has already commented on this, that if we take the period from 1958 to 1977, that probably in that period, which would be roughly 20 years, there would have been approximately 5 of those years that I should think anyone would reasonably define as having where we experience comfortable full utilization of our productive resources. There are, however, three basic points that I think are to be made on the side of the act, as it were. One of these is that while the incidence of cyclical fluctuations, in other words, the number of these years that where we had a recedence in output, turned out to be the same. Nonetheless, the severity of these declines in the earlier period was, of course, markedly greater. The average reduction, year to year, I should say, the average reduction in output in the earlier period was 3.8%, compared with somewhat less than that, I think about 1.2%, I guess it was 1.2% in this 30 years that we are now concluding. And of course, the most severe decline, namely from 1907 to 1908, of 8.2% was markedly greater than the most severe year-to-year decline this time, which would have been from 74 to 75. Now, the second point to make, and I think it's a very important one, is that while I excluded the Great Depression here for these comparative purposes, nonetheless, we did have a Great Depression. This time, at least during these 30 years, we have not had anything that would be in that category, and that in spite of the fact that we had our episodes here of very severe strains in the financial system. In 1970, again, 1975, I don't suggest again that in some manner, this is to be attributed to the Employment Act, but on the other hand, it is probably to be attributed to that greater understanding and perhaps greater attention to some of these fundamental problems of which the Employment Act is at least an expression. Now, there is one other point that I would like to make here, although it is not in my written statement. We need to remember that the management of economic policy this time is in the context of a period, particularly in recent years, where the impact on the U.S. economy of external economic development is markedly greater. For example, you just cannot explain the 1933 overheating of the domestic economy economy and let's take into account the extent to which we have sharp improvement in our trade position. And according to my rough calculation, if we had not happened to get the favorable swing in our trade position about the beginning of the sharp decline in 74, program analysis, what might be called micro issues, in contrast to the overall level of business activity of production and farming. The analysis of proposals for trade policies, for regulation or deregulation. I mean, this is an endless array of proposals, and I think this is mirroring the extent to which there is a growing focusing of economic analysis on these specific programmatic issues as well as just the overall. Well, I concluded my statement here by raising the question as quickly as to where we go from here. I will just make three summary comments. All of us would agree that the one area which has been particularly disappointing is in the area of price level stability, which is of course related to the unemployment problem also. This is a worldwide problem. I'm acutely aware of that, having participating now as I am in this OECD study to which the chairman has alluded. The second point is that I've made here is that I think the managers of economic policy can be asked to be even more forthcoming than has been the case up till now as to what the path is that would represent all things considered the optimum for the objective of economic policy. Now I conclude here with a third comment, which is addressed specifically to the Joint Economic Committee. And I make this from the vantage point of an elder statesman, as it were, who has been here and is now back in the grassroots. Reports of this committee in the earlier years reflected a substantial degree of unanimity. They had, therefore, a particularly influential weight in terms of the impact, I think, on the Congress and certainly in public education. Because they, by definition, therefore, they represented the combined judgment of the members of the Congress representing both political parties, representing a wide spectrum of ideological points of view, as to what they could agree on in terms of the importance of public policy. I think this was a very important matter. Now, the more modern tendency for majority reports and minority reports has, it seems to me, gone too far in the last several years. While the committee reports remain a major influence, this impact on thinking could be even greater if there were this greater emphasis on a greater degree of unanimity, such as, for example, the committee report on international economic policy. But I would conclude, Mr. Chairman, that an act and the institutions which it created, which have lasted for 30 years, and which has given the Joint Economic Committee, which has no legislative function, the status and influence which it has, not only within the Congress, but in the country at large, and which gives the Council of Economic Advisors, with a personnel of only 50, which in this city rounds off to zero, the kind of visibility and impact, all of this suggests to me that something must have been done right 30 years ago, and we would do well to keep that in mind as we ponder where to go from here.
Thank you very much. I must say that I think your vote for committed between minority and majority is highly ambitious. I, for one, and I think probably Senator Humphrey would echo this, would settle for unanimity on either side of that group. Either among the minority or among the majority. I think careful reading of the Joint Economic
Chairman, distinguished members of the Joint Economic Committee. We congratulate the committee, and especially you, Mr. Chairman, for your initiative in organizing this very timely conference on full employment. There's no more urgent challenge facing this country today than the challenge of getting people back to work and assuring plenty of good job opportunities in the years ahead for our expanding labor force. As you well know, it's not simply a matter of stimulating the economy with infusions of federal money. There are deep and disturbing structural problems that threaten to make high unemployment a chronic sickness in our society, especially among young people and minorities. Whatever legislation emerges from your deliberations must address these structural problems and avoid the temptation to concentrate strictly on short-term solutions. It is our belief that the primary thrust of any program to achieve full employment must be to restore the dynamism of the private sector, the productive core of our economy. The cyclical recovery already underway will help in this process, and we endorse the idea of extending the individual tax cuts and making them permanent in order to sustain the recovery. But our problems are so deep that even the individual tax cuts combined with investment incentives for business will take a few years to come into full force in terms of employment. Therefore, some immediate special employment measures may be required in the transition period. If a reasonable amount of public works projects can be set in motion quickly and not delayed until the economy is already recovered, you can provide temporary jobs for unemployed breadwinners, particularly in the hard-hit construction industry. That would be helpful, but it's an expensive approach of limited usefulness. Jobs for young people and minorities, generally with fewer skills and less experience, pose even more difficult problems and require longer-term structural solutions. Having in mind the temporary character of public service job programs, it might be a better investment to concentrate funds on Title I of the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, CETA, and begin to correct the mismatch between the jobs and the skills that are becoming locally available. It's reported that there are anywhere from 500,000 to 1 million unfilled jobs in the United States today, and we ought to have much better data on this. But the people with the necessary skills are not locally available to handle them. By giving people the training they need through CETA, we not only provide immediate income for both the trainees and the teachers, but also begin to get at the long-term problem of chronic unemployment or underemployment among minorities, youth, and women. Now, experience shows that a program such as CETA reaches young people with employment problems. Of the enrollees from July 1974 to June 1975, in Title I programs, 61% were under 22 years of age, 60% had less than 12 years of education, 45% females, 40% were minorities. Moreover, the CETA approach seems to get results. The Department of Labor reports for the period from July 74 to June 75, and that was the worst of the recession, of the 624,000 individuals who were enrolled in and left the programs under Titles I and II of CETA, 385,000, or better than 60%, were either placed in jobs or went on to more specific job training. We simply have to work harder in the next several years in the frustrating area of youth and minority unemployment. We cannot expect them to support our economic or our political system. Yet everyone recognizes that public service jobs and training programs are temporary expedients or transitional activities. And that's why any full employment program must concentrate on restoring the producer sector that provides most of the jobs, the income, and the tax revenues on which our economy operates. The nation's economic problems have been a long time developing. For most of the period between 1946 and the present, we've been favoring consumption over investment. We've been building up demand and neglecting supply. We've been expanding the government sector and neglecting the producer sector that supports it. Much good has flowed from these policies, but the one-sided emphasis is now catching up with us. The economy has drifted out of balance. The producer sector, weakened by underinvestment, forced deeply into debt by declining real profits, is not going to be able to support the ever-growing demand for jobs, tax-supported services, and rising standards of living that the people and their government expect. So we need tax policies that permit us to channel a larger proportion of our national output into capital formation. And we need restraint in the expansion of government services until we build up the tax base that will support them. Well, how much capital will business have to invest? The Council of Economic Advisers states that real business fixed investment, the funds needed to equip our growing labor force, will have to rise to 12% or more of GNP in 1975 through 1980, as compared with 10.4% averaged over the decades 65 through 74, in order to reduce the unemployment rate to even 5% by 1980. Our own economists say that this is not a reachable goal under present tax laws. We forecast that business fixed investment will not exceed 10% of GNP between now and 1980 because of inadequate funds and incentives to invest. The five charts that are at the back of our detailed statement show why business will not be able to generate the needed capital funds. Corporate profitability and return on investment have been in a basic long-term decline. Yes. Yes, they're at the long, at the back of the detailed statement. I'm just reading a brief one, Mr. Chairman. Inflation has also eroded the funds provided by depreciation, and so businesses had to turn outside for funds. New equity shares have become almost a negligible factor in capital formation because our tax system is heavily weighted in favor of debt rather than new equity. Therefore, most companies have plunged deeply into debt. The result of this plunge into debt and the squeeze on corporate funds is that corporate liquidity has all but disappeared. It is somewhat better now than it was a year ago, but far from adequate. No wonder most financial institutions are skittish about lending money to many businesses, and businessmen are probably reluctant to go further into debt. Corporations in these circumstances are just not going to be able to make the capital investments required. And reduced capital investments mean less economic activity, less employment, less improvement in productivity, less ability to compete with our overseas competitors, and less improvements in the standards of living. And these are the consequences of a tax structure weighted against capital formation and business investment. Now, what must be done to restore the ability of industry to modernize and expand our industrial machine, which is aging so badly? How can we trigger the capital investment boom that this country needs to reach full employment again? Well, we would certainly support the extension of recently enacted incentives, making the 10% investment tax credit permanent, and making permanent the tax cut on the first $50,000 of corporate income to help the struggling small businessman. But two other areas of tax policy must be changed over a period of years, starting now, if we are to restore vitality to the producer sector. One is the area of capital cost recovery. The Congress should legislate a capital cost recovery system which will allow producers to adjust their depreciation or capital allowances to compensate for the ravages of inflation. Yes. What we have in mind here is to permit deduction for tax purposes, depreciation of replacement costs rather than historic costs. Now, the other area that requires attention is integration of corporate and individual income taxes to eliminate the bias in favor of debt instruments and to stimulate the issuance of new equity. Again, there are several possible methods of achieving the required integration, and I don't wish to go into them here, but on both of these, we would suggest a start, realizing we can't afford the loss of tax revenues to go all the way at the beginning, but over a period of years, we could accomplish much. Now, I would like to point out in both these areas of taxation, our principal foreign competitors are well ahead of us. They have methods for minimizing the impact of inflation and double taxation that we badly need. And you know, we've got to remember that growing exports and international trade are so significant to our economy. Today, our exports of goods and services have grown to 10% of our GNP. They were just 6% 4 years ago. Mr. Finley's made reference to the jobs lost through imports, and no one is more sympathetic than I. We have lost something like 2,800,000 jobs through our growth in imports. But I would point out to you that we've gained 8.5 million jobs through this tremendous growth in exports. So we're 5.7 million jobs ahead, and they're jobs that pay on the average 25% more per hour. We must take care of Mr. Finley's people, though, through some form of adjustment situation. Now, let me just go on to conclude by saying that, as responsible legislators, you want to know how much such tax reductions can be and how they can be financed if we're going to keep the federal. federal deficit under control and prevent another dangerous round of inflation. Well, the basic offset, of course, is their only show is increasing economic activity and the employment that's generated by the proposed tax reduction. This will not only enlarge the individual and the corporate tax rates, but also produce savings in government expenses. A valuable side effect, of course, is the help that we provide hard-pressed state and local governments in terms of the new welfare costs. We estimate that a properly phased-in program would accelerate economic growth to the point where the program would be paying for itself. Beyond that, it starts to provide a fiscal bonus. More importantly, the cumulative effect of these actions on economic growth will produce extra jobs in the period of 76 to 80 and help bring unemployment down to more acceptable levels. Beyond that point, the demographics favors. We don't have the same structural problems, but we do have them in this period to 80. Now, this investment in job formation decisions this must be made this year by managers and companies large and small, so that the facilities will be in place to provide the jobs and the rising standards of living our people aspire to. That's why the Congress should restructure the tax laws affecting business if the nation is to return to full employment.
Thank you. not so startled by the illusion that he was old enough to remember the 50s. And I had a little difficulty tracking after that since I remember the 30s.
So a lot.
Well, good. I feel better. Well, that of course is a very large subject, and one could identify only. I think that probably we could do very little more than just identify the areas that ought to be explored here. One of the questions, of course, has to do with the definitions of unemployment. I do not mean by citing that to suggest that it's merely a definitional problem, but there is that dimension in trying to get figures that are roughly comparable. Now, it is also true that to the extent that one can reduce the figures to comparability, unemployment rates in the United States with any or at given levels of pressure on the price level seem to be higher. In other words, the relationship seems to be less favorable here. Without the same degree of pressure on the price level. I guess the third point that I would make, however, is that we bring ourselves up to date. The fact of the matter is that the kinds of problems that we're concerned about here, namely the problem of both high rates of unemployment and high rates of inflation, are quite general. It's the same kind of problem, varying degrees, which we see in most of the other countries of the industrial world. Hopefully, we are moving out of it. But in that respect, at least, there is a considerable degree of parallelism in our experience here vis-a-vis Japan or the other countries of the industrial world.
Could I add one other
question
to tracking?
Sure.
It is a fact, I understand, that our demographics are different. Their baby boom follows ours by 5 years. They will hit the same demographic problem about 80, 81 that we hit in 75, where we had 10% of our workforce in that very young age bracket where it's historically been 7. It will return to 7% in this country in about 1981, 82. I mean, the people are here, we know that. And in Europe, they hit it, as we've got it now, about 1981. The second factor, of course, is that they had to rebuild from the ravages of the war. And we poured in capital as well as their very high savings rate so that they have a much more modern industrial machine than we, and therefore higher productivity. You know, in Japan, for example, 32% of their machine tools are over 10 years of age. In the United States, that figure is 67%. I think these are some factors that create similarities.
I can tell you the group.
probably went too far one way in the direction of assuming some kind of reasonably invariant relationship, and they're now going too far in the sense of, in many cases, suggesting there's no relationship at all. I don't suppose that we were to pursue a policy by which the demand for output of these nominal terms, say in current dollars, were to rise substantially more rapidly than what seems to be ahead of us. If we put the economy under too much pressure, I would guess that we will see a price level response. I think that would be the general expectation also. There is, in other words, if one cannot go so far as to say that these are two totally different problems. I don't understand that, and I don't see any logic to support it. Moreover, in the very substantial amount of international experience that we've had with this elastic trade incoming policy, which I suppose ranges all the way from mild exploitation to outright wage price control, I don't see how one can read that experience and be confident that we have some kind of a wage and price control program to deal with the problem of inflation, by which then we can put the economy under pressure. Indeed, I would put it even more strongly. I think this has been one of the problems that countries who have tried these programs have run into, thinking that they had solved or have dealt with the problem of inflation by any of the policies. They overstimulated the economy and found themselves in earlier with the program blowing up. The OECD and its review of this experience certainly concluded that there might have been some temporary displacement effect on the wage cost level, on the price cost level, but that whether it had any very enduring impact was doubtful. And that's based on not only our own experience, but international experience. So I guess I would not see the logic that somehow or other these are too totally different.
Conference with this period. What I consider to be one of the quantitative and qualitative details of construction of those specific areas for the one. We can adopt the purpose of our legislation with the recognition of the special problem of our inner city, people who attend the inner city, direction of labor, production resources, social media, housing, community development, and life. And I ask that considering this area, even more consideration placed on these vital people, that the employment of minorities, especially youth, give special attention to an institutional problem rather than an individual by individual problem. Special scheme is given to compliance with the enforcement of non-discrimination provisions. The legislation defines employment for two girls who are working part-time while desiring full-time work. That an accurate information system be incorporated in the legislation by timely unemployment data relative to structural barriers and amounts of time and distribution of increased productivity in general. This legislation is profoundly important. other sections of the law. Now, with those remarks, I would like to say that it is likely, given the current change in the economy, that we would have difficulty in achieving full employment in the years ahead. And we need measures that would permit us to deal effectively with the energy shortages, the inevitable rise in the cost of energy, the foreign competition, the need to expand consumption without spoiling the environment, and a number of other environmental problems. Now, Mr. Jones, what is he going to answer? I am informed that multinational corporations like General Electric achieve a rate of return on investment that is higher in Western European countries that have some form of national economic plan than they do in the United States. And I'm interested in your chart number two, which shows the decline in the rate of return on investment during the period between 1965 and 1970. Now, if in fact that is the case, that is, if multinational corporations do very well in foreign countries that have a considerably greater involvement of government in the economic affairs of the nation,
the second thing that helped us, of course, was the general growth in the economy throughout the world in that period of 70 to 75. But a third very important factor was DISC legislation, which was passed by Congress. Because what DISC enabled us to do is to offset some of the advantages our international competitors had. And it made it a much better deal for us in many respects to manufacture the product here in the United States and ship it abroad. Get that tax saving here. Now, I would say that with respect to planned economies, with the possible exception of one, most of them have not been, I don't believe, that successful. What you're up against is a situation where labor does not have the mobility in many of these countries, and the redundancies are not permitted, that's what they call them there. And this has caused the government to have to pour more and more money into industry in order to keep it viable. I think that the economy in Italy is in shambles today. The economy in the UK, where 60% of their GNP now is in the public sector, is in great trouble. The economy in France is now experiencing difficulties. As you know, the franc is dropping precipitously. I've just come back from Japan, where the Japanese industrialists are all most pessimistic. Admittedly, their situation has not been as critical as ours, but they're telling me that there is no way that the economy in Japan is going to match the government planning statistics that have been outlined for the year 1976. It's about 2%, something on that order. They think that's very bad because they've had... Not quite. The First National City Bank letter of current issue has a very interesting section in it which compares the way we accumulate our unemployment statistics with the way the major industrialized nations around the world do it. And in each case, their unemployment statistics would be slightly higher if they were computed on our basis, but there's still a wide difference.
They're slightly higher.
No, they're slightly higher than reported, but still well below ours.
Yes, but I mean this, that they, in other words, they add more people, get more elements in their economy, is that what you're saying?
No, they, the way they accumulate the statistics, let me just give you a specific. In most of the Western European nations, the difference between their reported unemployment, if it were put on a U.S. basis, it would move up about 1 point. About 1 point. Japan is a slightly different. Murray, I think you wanted to add
something. Well, the Japanese labor pool, it would be closer to 4% on the same basis as ours, but it's still compared to our 7.6.
Yes,
this is their recent issue of the Japanese labor pool. So their stated figure of 2%, if you make it on a comparison basis to ours, would be about 4% to our 7.6.
And this fact that we have had as a base statistical a much higher rate of unemployment over the last 10, 15, 20 years, or at least 50 years, and any other industrialization in the world, is that true?
Yes, and while you were out, we mentioned that one of the reasons for this was that our demographics are different. Our baby boom is 5 years ahead of the European baby boom. We've got 10% of our workforce now, as you know, in the 19 and under age bracket. Historically, it's run about 7 to 8%.
But our population compared to many of the Europeans is older.
Not in this area. They will hit about 10%, which we have now in the 19 and under bracket, about 1981.
Right, may I just make this point about the sound of the radio? If you take the 15 years that you're talking about, Senator, from 1959 to 74, which would, I would think, you know, cover the point you're making about the demographic, Japan went from 2.2 to 2.74 to 1.4, and ours went from 5.5 to 5.6. They were always substantially under ours for a total every year for 15 years. So while there may be some demographic differences, that can't be the total answer.
No.
I think that's the point the Senator was referring to.
I think the point that Dr. Anderson was bringing up was that in these planned economies, you do not have the freedom, if you're an industrialist, to lay anybody off. In Japan, when you go to work for a certain company, you are with that company for life. That's their lifetime system. That has been the system in Japan.
Is that true of the companies like Sweden, who imported labor? They had full employment. Their underemployment was the Southern Italians, Portuguese, Turks, and some of them Spaniards. So they could get rid of them. But they have a very low, I don't think they were quite as frozen.
If I might interject a comment here, I think Mr. Jones would have to agree that the characteristic of the economic plan in almost every country is highly compatible with the basic institutions and values of those countries. For example, in Japan, they have long had a tradition of not laying off because the employers have an alternative relationship with the employees, very different from what I fancy with the economic plan in Germany. That's look ahead.